I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Expectant moms are told about their baby's development, about breastfeeding, sleep schedules, diet, and their health, but not much, if anything, about postpartum depression. It can be a frightening experience. Here's South Philly mom Lindsay Love describing one morning with her baby.
I remember speaking to my girlfriend on the phone and saying, I can't do this. And she's like, what do you mean? Where's the baby? And I said, well, he's on the floor in front of me and I just want nothing to do with him. Like, he's screaming, I'm crying, and I'm done. It's 8 a.m. and I can't go on with this day.
It's estimated that 1 in 7 moms will experience postpartum depression from mild to debilitating. A government panel appointed by the Department of Health and Human Services has recommended that women be screened for PPD during and after their pregnancy. This is a first and will hopefully reduce the stigma associated with postpartum depression. We're going to talk about the symptoms and the treatment, and we have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Neil Epperson is a professor of psychiatry and obstetrics gynecology at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, also director of the Penn Center for Women's Behavioral Wellness and co-director of the Penn Promotes Research on Sex and Gender in Health. Neil Epperson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Marty.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Karen Kleiman, founder and executive director of the Postpartum Stress Center on the Main Line outside of Philadelphia, author of several books on postpartum depression, including This Isn't What I Expected, Overcoming Postpartum Depression, and Therapy and the Postpartum Woman. And Karen Kleiman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times
Thank you, Marty.
I do want to talk to both of you, but I want to go back to Lindsay Love, who spoke with Radio Times producer Liz Fiedler. Lindsay's a South Philadelphia mom and has struggled or did struggle with postpartum depression. She explained to Liz that while she was pregnant, she struggled to feel connected to her son, and this was an effort to shield herself from the pain of a previous miscarriage.
My journey with postpartum kind of started when my husband and I had a miscarriage before we had our son, and I never really dealt with that miscarriage. So what ended up happening with my pregnancy with my son is that I didn't really connect with the pregnancy, and so I kind of started from this mentally detached place as a way to protect myself from getting hurt again, because with the first pregnancy that was the miscarriage, I was all in. And I told everyone on the first second, and we found out that that pregnancy wasn't viable at 13 weeks. But for those however many weeks I knew, those 7 or 8 weeks, I mean, I literally told anyone. Like, if I sneezed and somebody said, bless you, I'd be like, oh, I'm pregnant. Like, anybody walking down the street, I just told everyone. I was so excited. We had been trying for a while, so I was all about it. I was like puffing my stomach out even though nothing was happening. And then when I was pregnant with my son, I didn't do any of that. I almost hid it. I didn't want to talk about it. I didn't look at other pregnant women on the street and give that like, I know and so am I. Like, I didn't do that. And I didn't feel warm and fuzzy feelings around it. I didn't want to talk about it. I didn't want to tell anyone. We didn't tell anyone until I was 5 months. We had some inkling that he was going to be very small, so I was induced 3 weeks early, and he actually ended up being in the NICU, and that we were not expecting. We didn't think he would be so small that he would have to stay in the NICU, and so I'm a planner. I like to be prepared for things. I did not really know that was coming. I don't even think my physicians knew that was coming, so it left me feeling really helpless when he was first born. We would go and visit him in the NICU, but it felt very much like he was their property. And I guess I just didn't feel ownership. Like, I didn't feel like, well, this is my baby and I'm the one in charge. It felt like, okay, I bet I should sit and I should wait for them to finish what they need to do. And there was a nurse who told me, she's like, well, don't come during this time because we do a shift change. And I thought, oh gosh, like I better just follow the rules. And I think I set myself up for this kind of like secondary position with him.
We're going to hear more from Lindsay Love throughout the hour. Let me turn to you, Neil Epperson. And what we hear from her is this, you know, great joy about being pregnant the first time, has a miscarriage. And then I'm not sure if it's a difficult pregnancy, but certainly not the same kind of joy and experience that she had anticipating this child.
Her story is so familiar to me, and I'm sure to Karen as well, particularly women when they've had the trauma of having lost a previous pregnancy. And I think we have to really stop for a moment and call it what it is. When you're pregnant and you're so excited, as soon as you know you're pregnant, that baby is alive to you. That baby is developing inside of you, and you're connecting to it. And some people, that happens quicker than others. But for most women, it's very exciting. And so to lose that is like losing somebody. It's losing a possibility. And so people do feel traumatized by that loss. And exactly what she did to protect herself is what people do when they've had a trauma. They don't want to go there again. So to not connect with this pregnancy, to not get so excited is really understandable, but not helpful, like she said.
And just one more question about Lindsay. We'll be getting back to her. To you, Karen, what happened was that the baby ends up in the NICU, and she kind of can't. This baby is sort of under the control of other people,
which is trauma number two. And the funny part about this is that it's sort of counterintuitive, because what happens is her family and her support system are probably saying things like, now you have your baby, so let's bring out the joy and look how grateful we need to be and focus on the positive, and which is so not where she is. And if the grieving for the previous loss hasn't even taken place, and now she's grieving again for a potential, oh my God, maybe he's not okay, and all she's hearing is she's not feeling good enough, so she shuts down.
So what is postpartum depression? I think for many moms, you're sleep deprived, your life, your schedule is turned upside down. But that's not exactly what postpartum depression is. Go ahead.
Right. I mean, I think for most people, they know intellectually that having a baby is going to be a huge change in their life, not only for themselves but for their partners. If they are with a partner who's planning to co-parent that child, it's a huge adjustment. And so, yes, the sleep disruption and what have you. But postpartum depression is a little bit more than sort of feeling stressed by, you know, the adjustment of caring for a new child and the sleep deprivation. People do have low mood. A lot of times they're very anxious and agitated. They may even find that they're even overly concerned about their baby, so that they're checking the baby a lot and, you know, and worried about the baby's well-being to the point that it's not helpful. It's to the point that it's actually upsetting to them. Sleep is a problem. Usually they can't sleep even when the baby's sleeping. They're anxious waiting for the baby to wake up, so they have even more of a sleep disruption than what the baby provides. They often feel like they're being a bad mother for a lot of the reasons that Karen was talking about, is because they know they don't feel the way they thought they should feel, and they're not experiencing the level of joy and excitement. And let's face it, having a brand new baby isn't all joy and excitement. But for these women, they can't seem to connect even with minutes of joy. And that really makes them feel guilty. And so they feel bad about themselves.
Go ahead, Karen.
Just to add to that, one of the problems for healthcare providers and moms both is that the symptoms overlap with what we consider to be normal changes during the postpartum period. So how do I know if I'm okay, if I'm worried and I'm not sleeping and I'm obsessing a little bit? How do I know if I'm experiencing something that's, you know, clinically significant, or if I'm just having a hard time adjusting? It's hard to know. And by the way, it doesn't help when healthcare providers aren't educated to also know the difference.
Oh, just to say, you know, you're not exactly
right. We still
behaving the way
we still have doctors and healthcare providers. That doesn't mean there aren't fabulous ones, but there are many who are telling a 9-month postpartum woman that she has the blues, and she should go home and take a walk or have a glass of wine, and she'll feel better. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are some criteria that we've been putting out there for a pretty long time.
Well, that's the reason you're here, because you both have been putting this criteria out. I mean, is it intensity and longevity, Karen?
Well, that's exactly right. We talk about frequency, intensity, and duration. So it's not necessarily what they're experiencing. All new moms cry. All new moms are anxious. All new moms worry. All new moms are exhausted. But when those feelings are impairing her ability to function or get through the day, her level of distress is really what calls attention to right. her suffering right. and need for treatment.
Right. How much of this is hormonal? I mean, you know, a pregnant woman, the hormones are doing just extraordinary things.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm glad you bring it up because, you know, during pregnancy, your hormones are changing so dramatically. You know, hormones that you normally experience fluctuations in across the menstrual cycle, those hormones, estrogen and progesterone, they increase even more during pregnancy, 10 to 100 fold. So, I mean, your brain is bathed in these hormones that have very pronounced effects on neurochemistry. You know, estrogen has very enhancing effects to the serotonin system. Progesterone, through its metabolites, affect brain systems that we know are involved in relaxation, calming the brain, calming anxiety. And so your brain is bathed in these during pregnancy. And then with the delivery of the baby and the placenta, you go down to levels of postmenopausal woman. I mean, some women...
A postmenopausal
oh,
woman.
Oh, absolutely.
So just you're shedding all this.
You're shedding all these hormones, and it takes a while for your own ovaries to start to kick back in. And we're not even talking about the stress hormones of pregnancy as well and how high they are in pregnancy. So even your stress axis and how you respond to stressors in the postpartum period, it takes weeks to months to get back to your prepartum way of responding to stress and as well as having these ovarian changes.
So who is at risk? I mean, women are going through this as they're pregnant, but not everyone is going to get postpartum
well, you
depression.
Know, it is amazing to me that not everyone experiences postpartum depression. Mm-hmm. But that just
considering what the body's going through?
Considering what the body's going through and the emotional changes and the interpersonal relationship changes, it is unbelievable that we're really only talking about maybe around 13 to 14% of postpartum women having significant enough depression that they probably should be seeking treatment. I would say that there are other women that still should also seek mm-hmm. treatment that are outside of that 14%. But, you know, again, when we think about major depressive illness and come up with these criteria, it's around 10 to 13% that meet those criteria. So in any case, it is surprising. But to me, that's as a psychiatrist who does brain research, it just tells me how fascinating the brain is, that the brain of the average person can adjust to these huge fluctuations that occur over 24 to 48 hours. And that in women who have postpartum depression, we do think that their brain is not adjusting to these hormonal changes. It's not that they had abnormal hormone levels per se. It's just that whatever happened during the pregnancy, the brain did not adjust in a way that is now leaving them feeling not depressed.
We're almost having a break here, Karen. Are women who are prone to depression, are they at greater risk for postpartum depression?
I did want to add that there are, you know, there are also environmental and psychological factors that do make a mom more at risk, and things like her marriage, her relationship, her social support. If she had a previous depression or anxiety, all these things will make her more vulnerable. Again, it doesn't mean she will get depressed. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of women who get depressed and anxious after the delivery that have no risk factors. So that's another reason why we look at this and go, you know, what's exactly happening? Some women are more sensitive to these changes than others.
Right. Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about postpartum depression in this hour of Radio Time, something that doesn't often get talked about in a doctor's office or sometimes in a hospital delivery room or a delivery room wherever a baby is being born. Talking with Karen Kleiman, and she's founder, executive director of the Postpartum Stress Center. On the main line here in Philadelphia, Neil Epperson, professor of psychiatry and obstetrics gynecology at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, also director of the Penn Center for Women's Behavioral Wellness. 1-888-477-9499. Give us a call and stay with us much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Karen Kleiman and also Neil Epperson about postpartum depression. We began the show with a conversation with Lindsay Love, who talked with Radio Times producer Elizabeth Fiedler. Let's hear Lindsay now. Her son is 4 months old. Her friends are rather concerned about what's going on with her. And in a very difficult moment, she calls her therapist, a woman named Perry, whom she credits with helping her deal with her depression and anxiety. Let's give it a listen.
We took our son on a trip, so we flew with him, and that was pretty stressful, even though he was great on the plane. And we stayed with my in-laws. And there's a 4-month sleep regression that I did not know about. And our son was not sleeping the entire time we were on this trip. So I was in someone else's home, even though my in-laws are lovely, I was just not in the comfort of my own home. I was going into the shower to cry hysterically. I mean, it was a disaster. And because my son wasn't sleeping. And when we came home, we worked with a sleep therapist to try to help us all figure out like a napping schedule. And I clung so tightly to that schedule. I would just cancel all of our plans. I would say, no, we have to be home at this time. We have to do this. And I was diligent about that routine. And anytime something would go wrong, because my son is a human and not a robot, I would lose it. I mean, I was inconsolable. I was angry. I mean, I would scream at my husband. I would scream at my son. And then I would hate myself for having screamed at them. And this was a side that I had never seen of myself. And the way I thought about it before I was in therapy was, oh, I'm just not good at being a mom. I'm not good at this. Other people are stronger than I am, and I'm weak. I've made a terrible mistake, and I'm not cut out to be a mother. And I remember speaking with Perry on the phone, and I felt this great sense of relief that my friends were here, that they were going to help me out. And then Perry tells me, I don't want you to be alone with your son. And I was like, you must be talking to someone else. You can't be talking to me. What a ridiculous thing to say. And she said, no, I think for everybody's benefit, I'm just, until we get a plan together, until I can speak with you, until we can get a session started and I can get a read on your symptoms, I don't want you to be alone with your son. And that, I mean, I felt like I walked into a wall and I started crying and I thought, I can't believe you're saying this to me. It's a hard thing to be told that you shouldn't be alone with your child. I mean, it's something that as women we're told, it's the greatest joy of your life. And, you know, you're going to immediately fall in love with this baby. And I already was struggling with sort of this detachment. I wasn't feeling overwhelming love for him.
Again, Lindsay Love talking to us about her experiences of postpartum depression. We will get back to her a little bit later on in the show. Karen, she says some really profound, moving, touching, sad things there. One that, you know, I'm not good at being a mom, feeling that way as if she's not a good mom. And then, of course, being told perhaps you should be careful about being with your child.
One of the things that makes that distinguishes postpartum depression from other clinical depressions is precisely that the symptoms feel like who you are. And so when we say, you know, you have a sore throat, that, you know, your glands are swollen and you have a fever, these are symptoms. When you have symptoms of postpartum depression, I shouldn't have had this baby. I'm not a good mother. I made a mistake. My husband's going to leave me. So it's the core of who she is. And she doesn't know how to differentiate that. And when we as therapists say, this is not who you are, these are symptoms. And when we treat the symptoms, you will feel better and you will no longer think this way. But the distorted thinking is so internalized to her that she can hardly face herself.
Mm-hmm. What you don't hear in that tape, Neil, is that she had a couple of friends who saw that she was in distress and came over and actually did a kind of intervention with her to say, we need to figure out how to get you help.
Yes, that was amazing. And kudos to her friends. I mean, it is not easy to do that. But because she's already feeling so bad about herself and thinking that she's a bad mother, this keeps women in silence because they don't want to let other people know that they're having a difficult time. Because, of course, everybody else has the perfect family. Everybody else is the perfect mother. And so there's shame. And there's shame about wanting to admit this to her friends. So I am so grateful to her friends that they reached out to her and really kind of said, you know, we need to do something here, hon.
So what is the treatment? She mentions her therapist, Perry. How is postpartum depression treated? I'll start with you, Neil.
Okay. I mean, it's an important question. And I think the fact that she got in with a therapist who understands postpartum depression is really important because I think it is sometimes, you know, not as understood by other people. I think the one issue she brings up about the therapist saying, you know, that maybe she shouldn't be with the baby right away, it's, again, I can't tell exactly why that was said, but it kind of, according to what she's saying, it sort of sounds like the therapist wasn't quite sure, not having really fully evaluated her yet, was she safe to be with the baby? Because there is something called postpartum psychosis, which is very different than postpartum depression. Postpartum psychosis is a much more mood lability. People can be very delusional. They can have beliefs that the baby would be better off dead because they're a bad parent. And they can actually be hearing voices or having thoughts that tell them that they should harm the baby, that it would be in the baby's best interest. And as a provider, if you don't know the patient, you need time to evaluate that. And the main thing I want to reassure is that most women with postpartum depression don't have that. And postpartum psychosis is very rare. It's only 2 out of 1,000 pregnancies. So it's a very small percentage of women who experience that.
I would really like mention the scary thoughts with postpartum depression, because it's so hard to distinguish them. And women do think they're going mad. They do think that these are crazy thoughts. And they do not want to talk about it for fear that they will be labeled or somebody will take their baby away or so forth. But the agitation that Neil referred to earlier is so prevalent. And postpartum anxiety, depression is so agitating that it can often be expressed with scary, negative, intrusive thoughts that come out of nowhere about me hurting the baby or harm coming to the baby, but me actually doing something to hurt my baby. That does feel crazy to them. When they say it to somebody who knows what that is, we know she's not going to hurt her baby, and her level of distress is what tells us that it's anxiety-driven and not delusional.
Right. Women who are delusional and actually have, you know, we've heard about them in the media, harm their children, they're psychotic at that point, meaning that they're functioning in a way that is not realistic. They're believing things that are not in reality, and that is a much more dangerous emergency situation.
Rather than a kind of fleeting fantasy that you might have, like, I can't take this anymore.
Well, everybody wonders if they're going to do things to harm their child at some point. You know, if you make a bad decision, does that, you know, should I take my kid to the pediatrician or should I not? I mean, we all have these as natural concerns as parents.
But it can also get really bad with obsessing. You know, there's a postpartum OCD where every time I go into the kitchen, I see the knives, I get these flashes, I get these images. Every time I bathe the baby, I see myself pushing the baby under the water. What is happening?
Yeah, what is that?
What is happening? These are negative thoughts that are part of, you know, the obsessional component of postpartum depression.
So what is therapy like? I mean, if someone's going to a talk therapist, well, what do they talk about?
Believe it or not, I mean, I don't know what the statistics are behind this, but women can feel enormously better when they say this out loud to somebody who knows what this is, and we say back, this is okay.
Yes.
I know it feels terrible, and there are things that we can do about it, but I am not worried that you're going to hurt your baby. Well, the distress goes way
down. Just by saying the words.
Way down.
Mm-hmm. And with the distress going down, I mean, it's interesting. We have a tendency to think things that are also linked with scary thoughts, you know, and scary feelings. So when you have the thought that you might take one of those knives and hurt your baby or dunk your baby into the water, you have this horrific response to it as a mom. How could I possibly think that? Oh, my God. Well, then that horrific response just cements those thoughts in your brain. So our job as clinicians is to try to help them stop linking that horrific feeling with the thought and just try and let the thought float away instead of having that kind of emotional reaction to it.
And is that effective then, talk therapy? Is that sort of the gold standard dealing with postpartum depression?
Well, talk therapy is certainly important, and I can let Karen talk a little bit more about that in specific. But yes, antidepressants are also quite helpful, particularly with the anxiety. Getting people in a better sleep pattern and using different kinds of sleep hygiene is also really important. And then obviously we're also studying new treatments for postpartum depression that we can talk about.
But even if, let's say, a woman is breastfeeding, should they be concerned about taking medications?
At this point, we've done research, our group as well as many others throughout the country, as well as in North America, focusing on the use of antidepressants during breastfeeding, as well as some of the sleep medications. And the babies do get very, very small amounts of these medications. But in the most situations, you do not see any adverse effects on the baby. And so we do believe that it is better for a mom to continue to breastfeed if she wants to do that and not use breastfeeding as a reason not to take medication, because it is so important that they do both if they can.
Let me ask you, we have a lot of people that want to join the conversation. A question to you, Karen, and this is a broad generalization, but do you think a lot of moms today feel under pressure to sort of be the perfect mom, to to breastfeed without hesitation, to have a schedule. We hear a little bit from Lindsay about, you know, wanting to be in control and feeling that I have to do this perfectly.
We did hear that from Lindsay, and that is we don't like to link mental health with personalities, but there does seem to be an association between moms who do tend to be more perfectionistic, maybe a little OCD-ish like, and wanting their lives to be in control, to be a little bit more at risk for this, because there's nothing more out of control than having a baby.
Absolutely.
So, but the pressure these days, it's always been there, to be honest with you. I mean, I felt it, you know, 33 years ago. But the pressure these days with social media and with all those things that we don't even want to go into right now is just enormously hard on moms who are working so hard to feel good. And we're talking about moms who aren't necessarily clinically depressed, but on everybody, yes.
Mm-hmm. Let me reintroduce you both. That's Karen Kleiman. She's founder and executive director of the Postpartum Stress Center in suburban Philadelphia. She's written a couple of books about postpartum depression, including This Isn't What I Expected and Therapy in the Postpartum Woman. And Neil Epperson, also with us, professor of psychiatry and obstetrics gynecology at the Perelman School of Medicine. That's at the University of Pennsylvania. Director of the Penn Center for Women's Behavioral Wellness and co-director of the Penn Promotes Research on Sex and Gender in Health. Bit of a mouthful there for both of our guests, but this is what they have been doing for years now. And we've got calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes at whyy.org, and you can tweet us at whyy Radio Times. Let me get Erica from Westchester to join us. Erica, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much taking the time to discuss this amazing, difficult, overwhelming journey that so many women feel. I just want to comment that I can relate to Lindsay. I did not know necessarily that I had postpartum depression until after my second child, because the feeling was so different for me compared to my first child. So I also want to credit that therapy was essential during those first probably 2.5 years after my first child. And that, and the supportive husband, is really what got me through.
Well, Erica.
And then when I had my second child, it was a completely different experience.
Well, that's really good to go. We're going to leave you a lot of air there in the background. But she raises several interesting points, Neil. One is that it was a much better experience with her second child, and she had support
right,
therapy.
Right, right. And I think that makes a huge difference, because she also knew a little bit more of what to expect. And, you know, and again, every pregnancy and every postpartum period is different. Even though we do see that women who've had maybe some mild depression after the first child can sometimes have more severe depression the second time, it can also go the other way. So I try and tell women who've had a serious postpartum depression that they shouldn't automatically assume it's going to happen to them again, and that because they now know what's going on, we can think about it prospectively, and we are there for them, providing the supports and sort of watching to make sure that they don't kind of go down that rabbit hole again with the second delivery.
Karen?
Just on a tangent, I just want to mention her husband and his support, which is so vital. We have a lot of research that shows that can really make a difference in preventing and inhibiting the depression. But I also want to mention that he's more at risk when she's depressed.
Well, I was going to – go ahead. That's
so,
an important
so
point.
So he's there. It's almost like he's holding his breath the whole time, and he's very supportive of her. She starts getting better, and sometimes we can just sort of see a shift in that equilibrium, and he can start manifesting some symptoms.
Of
that
postpartum
need,
depression.
Of depression.
Of depression himself. Mm-hmm. I appreciate the call, Erica. Let's see what Kathy from Newark, Delaware has to say. Kathy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'm a physical anthropologist. I teach at the University of Delaware. And one of the things I teach my students is that whether or not the mother is breastfeeding is critically important, because if you have a baby, go through labor and delivery, and then don't breastfeed, your body interprets that as the baby died. And you're in mourning. You're in hormonal grieving. And people have such poor education about breastfeeding.
Well, you know what, Kathy, I'm going to jump in here only because my guests are having a reaction to your comment. I have to be honest here, and I don't want to get off on a tangent on breastfeeding, especially mandatory breastfeeding. But Karen, go ahead. I want to give you a chance to weigh in. Do you want to?
I worry a lot about moms who are feeling pressured to breastfeed. I'm a great breastfeeding advocate. I loved breastfeeding my children. I have seen it make women very, very sick, and I'm talking about the pressure, not the breastfeeding, to breastfeed for the wrong reasons. I'm the first person to encourage a woman to breastfeed. I'm the first person to tell her we might need to think about discontinuing if it's making her sick.
I totally agree with that, because you know the truth is that I've seen so many women, and you know this sort of classic postpartum depression that I see, that seems to me, you know, again, we talked about there are a lot of reasons why women might get depressed, but when I see a woman coming into my office within 2 weeks of delivery, 3 weeks of delivery, and with really intense symptoms, I often see them as possibly this is in this person, the hormones may have played a bigger role. Maybe they've got the supportive husband, they wanted the baby, there's everything else in place, and for some unbelievable reason, now they're incredibly agitated. And these women are breastfeeding. Mm. So it certainly didn't protect them from it. And so I think it is important, the breastfeeding question, and I appreciate the anthropologist's point of view, because I think it's certainly valid in a lot of ways. But I also think that you can't tell every woman that to stop breastfeeding is going to help them or hurt them, that they need to be thinking about it on an individual level.
And it's not a death, so to speak, I mean, to use that kind of language.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in the screening. I mean, one of the reasons we wanted to do the show is that there was a panel from Health and Human Services and said it's time to really have screening for pregnant women. And I'm looking at you, Karen. Do you see this as a game changer?
It's very exciting. Some of us have been waiting for this kind of, you know, attention for a very long time. It's very exciting to expand the national conversation and really implement it and put it into place. You know, I always look at the other side, like, uh-oh, is there going to be a downside to this? And there can be. There can be. There's no downside to the fact that we've gained momentum and there's attention being placed here and the providers are taking it seriously. The screening itself, you know, it's only as good and only as valid as a mom's willingness to disclose how she's feeling.
Right.
So depending on who's doing the screening, how is it being done, how are we asking these questions, is she going to tell us the truth? Because she's got some really bad symptoms and thoughts that she's having that she's not putting down on a piece of paper if she doesn't feel good about the person who's sitting next to her.
And that's absolutely the case. And I also worry from a provider point of view is that, yeah, we can do all the screening we want, but then who's going to see the woman after the fact? And how are they going to get into treatment? And we have insurance issues, and some people aren't covered, and some places take certain insurances and others don't. And then there are a number of people in private practice that, you know, for reasons that I totally get and understand, they're not taking insurance at all. And so we wind up not, you know, the people that are doing the screening, who are they going to refer these ladies to? And that's a real concern as well. So yeah, I kudos to the government for making this recommendation, but we need to do more.
Oh, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Neil Epperson and Karen Kleiman about postpartum depression. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. I'll read some comments. We have comments at Radio Times at WHYY.org and at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking about postpartum depression with Karen Kleiman and also Neil Epperson. And we've been hearing from Lindsay Love throughout the hour, a South Philadelphia mom. She was describing her experience of postpartum depression. And here's Lindsay again talking about how therapy has helped her, also how getting out of the house is important. Let's give it a listen.
I only did talk therapy, and then figuring out that though I was the primary caretaker for my son, I needed to make sure that I punctuated our days with visits from other people. So whether that be we join like a mother's group, or if we just take a walk to the library, we had to be around other people so that I could kind of maintain balance and just get myself out of the house, quite literally, just get myself out of the house. And then as my symptoms subsided, I kind of forgot what the things were that I was supposed to do. And when my son was about 12 months old, my husband was back on a job where he was working a lot of hours and wasn't able to help with our son as much. And we kind of fell into the same pattern as before, where I was feeling really overwhelmed and depressed.
And again, Lindsay Love, if you want to hear more of Liz's interview with her, go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. Let me read a couple of comments here. One from Shannon. He says, as a man trying to better understand the emotions running through a woman's mind and want to know the best way to help them, out asking the right questions if they're experiencing any of the symptoms to be helpful or invasive. This is a man. He wants to help.
That's adorable.
It is adorable. Let me put that to you, Karen. I mean, more than adorable.
There's a book called The Postpartum Husband that's written for Shannon, by the way. It's for the husband who doesn't know what to do, doesn't know what to say, and everything I say makes it worse. You know, because if I say I'll be home early, it means, you know, then she feels guilty. If he says, you know, then I'll be home late, he doesn't care. It doesn't matter what he says. So it's wonderful that he's asking this question. And the best person to ask is really his wife. You know, what is it that I can say to you that will help you? What is it that you need? Moms actually have the script. They have the script. Sometimes moms will actually say, and maybe it's that with the help from a therapist, that say, here's what I need you to do. Or when you do this, it bothers me. Or when you do this, it helps. Most of the time what we're talking about is hard for men, but what we're talking about is to be with her. And being with her means don't try and fix it. Don't try and change it. Don't tolerate the fact that she's going to feel bad for a while. Sit with her. Tell her that you love her. Tell her she's a good mother. And, you know, endure this with her. The pressure to feel better makes her feel that he doesn't know how bad she feels.
Right. And a lot of times, and again, I don't want to be gender biased here, but, you know, I do know a lot of men who have a tendency to want to fix things. That's kind of what they want their wife to feel better, because a lot of times they're trying to figure out their role as a father. And, you know, and I need to be helping my wife, and if my wife is struggling. So sometimes the urgency to say things to try and fix them, to make them better, is not sitting with it, but I know that they're anxious, and when we get anxious, we do want to fix the situation. We're doers. We want to fix it. So I think that Karen's point of being able to sit with the woman, hear what she has to say, and be able to tolerate her distress also helps her to know that it's not so horrible, that you too can sit and tolerate how bad she's feeling.
Let me get an anonymous caller that wants to join us. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, how are you? I actually am lucky enough to have been working with Dr. Epperson through a lot of things. I also have suffered with postpartum, and it's been amazing that Lindsay was able to share that story. I did want to mention, you know, Lindsay talks about the miscarriage and having these risk factors, and that, you know, you don't always have risk factors. I had a perfectly normal pregnancy. I haven't ever had depression in the past, and had my baby, and it hit me like a ton of bricks. So, you know, you don't always know it's coming. I was also breastfeeding, so per the earlier caller, that has nothing to do with anything. And for me, like Kathy said, it made it far worse. My anxiety related to that was through the roof. I was not able to function. And also, I just wanted to agree with what Neil said about doctors not taking insurance, making it so much harder to get the treatment we need. I ended up with a doctor who didn't specialize in postpartum, and he wasn't able to provide me the help I needed, and it wasn't until I saw Neil that I was able to start feeling better.
That's really nice, and Neil's very pleased that you called and kind of aw shucks over here. But I know I do appreciate the call, and I think what our caller reinforces is that every story is unique. I mean, yes, there are certain symptoms in common, but everyone has their own special story.
Absolutely.
What kind of research are you doing then?
Well, right now we are testing a new product. It's made from progesterone. I talked a little bit about progesterone being high in pregnancy and sort of just plummeting in the postpartum period. But progesterone gets converted to something that's people don't need to remember this long word, allopregnanolone. We say allo for short. But allo has very sort of anti-anxiety effects and sedating effects in the body. And in order for a woman to get through pregnancy without being so sedated the entire pregnancy, obviously her brain needs to adjust to the sedating effects of this particular steroid. And we think that in the company that's making this medication is called Sage Therapeutics, and it's a multi-site trial where we're basically providing allopregnanolone to postpartum women with the hope that we can kind of reset that neurotransmitter system that we think has kind of gone awry in the postpartum woman. And we are still enrolling for that study. And so if women feel that they have severe postpartum depression and then particularly a lot of anxiety, a lot of low mood, difficulty sleeping, they might meet criteria for that study. And then we do provide ongoing treatment in our center at the Penn Center for Women's Behavioral Wellness after completion of the study. And so it's really, it takes somebody with some altruism to participate in research. and some people get really scared. Sure. But all I can say is that we're a nice group of people and we have your best interests at heart.
Fair enough. Let me get Elizabeth from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Elizabeth. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I'm a former patient of Women's Behavioral Health at Penn, and it saved everything, so I'm so happy with that. I just want to mention like the important role of both medication and counseling in the process, because I really needed both to be adjusted, and it's definitely like the hormone levels, I think, made a big effect. The other thing is, I really feel like I should have been the person to know that this was going to happen to me, because I had a high-risk pregnancy. I'm advanced maternal age. I did multiple rounds of IVF, and I also have friends who work in maternal fetal medicine, and knowing all of that, I should have known I was high-risk, but I didn't want to accept that I had it, I guess. Maybe that control factor. And I had friends who kept reminding me, I think this is what you have. You should get help. And it wasn't until like I had picked a window to jump out of that I realized, okay, I really have an issue. And I was also involved in Penn's pregnancy and changing emotion study. And when I gave my responses, I kept saying, it's okay to take medication. It's okay to seek help. It's okay to do all these things. And I finally had to let myself say, you can do the things that you think it's okay for other people to
do. Oh, that's fascinating, Elizabeth. I really appreciate the call to Radio Times, kind of underscoring the fact that you can know all this stuff, but you don't necessarily accept that it's going on, Karen, in your own heart
and
head.
It's very personal, but it's also very, you know, the bigger picture is the stigma is just so big. You don't want to say it out loud to yourself, to anyone else. The stigma of having it is one thing. The stigma of saying it out loud. And then the stigma that she points out of treatment. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, this much treatment is okay. I'll go to a support group, or I'll step it up and I'll go to therapy. But medicine I don't want to do, because if I take medicine, then that means I'm really, you know, mentally ill. Okay, right. We do know that the state-of-the-art treatment is the combination of supportive psychotherapy and antidepressant medication for moderate to severe depression.
Right. And the medication that we're studying, if it's shown to be effective, it's a game changer, because it's a natural product that a woman's body makes already. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, it's so fascinating, the idea that we could harness the body's own, you know, chemicals to try and use them as antidepressants in the right circumstances. And so, again, it's really, you know, important to be thinking about new medications that might work for these women.
I'm also thinking about the numbers of single moms in this country. We know that, you know, the high rate of single parenthood, and imagining Karen going through this without a partner or a spouse of some sort, or a support network, and feeling, and perhaps having a couple of other kids at home, and perhaps, you know, in a low-income neighborhood, just all those compounding stresses, and then dealing with postpartum depression on top of that.
Right, and that's when we sit there as professionals and sit there silently to ourselves going, oh, my God, how can we possibly help this woman?
There's so many
layers and layers and layers, and without the support, it's really complicated. Sometimes getting her to the office is complicated. Mm-hmm. So it really does ramp things up a lot and make it a little bit more urgent.
I mean, does it affect the parent-child relationship, or can it affect the parent-child?
Certainly any of these stressors can. Any of these stressors can. But often we see moms who are so resilient that they overcompensate in ways that's still primary, and they can still attend in ways that are remarkable to me personally when they are so lacking in resources.
Right.
Is there a reason that this has not been talked about in the doctor's office? Or, I mean, has it been just, We haven't known enough about what postpartum depression is, or even treatments, or there's something about the rosy picture of parenthood or motherhood, and thinking we don't want to cloud that in any way.
Well, I think that's a great question, and you know, there are reports in ancient literature about, you know, mood symptoms related to things like menstruation, mood symptoms related to the menopause, or mood symptoms related to birth. And so it's not a new phenomenon. I mean, we've been having, you know, babies for very long.
That's why we're all here, right?
Exactly. So this is really not new. I mean, and I think that every time we take a few steps forward to get people thinking about postpartum depression and get, you know, people to seek treatment, I think in some ways we're taking some steps back. And I think social media in some ways can be harnessed for good, but I think it also can be harnessed in this situation for bad. Because I think the one thing about social media is that we have a tendency to project our best stays on social media. Right. And there's a lot of putting new babies on and, oh, how cute and, oh, how wonderful we are as a couple. So everybody projects their best self out in their Twitter feeds and Instagrams and that kind of thing. And so I think we've got to figure out how to harness, you know, the social media to be able to get more information out about this so that people don't think that that's the real world, that that harm, you know, that facade
that everyone
looks like this, and I'm the only one suffering.
The flip side of that is that media sort of sensationalizes only the worst stories and only the horrific stories, which actually does nobody any good because moms sit back in silence and say, I am not, you know, talking about how I feel now. So we have both of those things going on. And again, moms don't know exactly. To address what you said about the doctors, I do want to say that most doctors don't consider mental, unless they're psychiatrists, don't consider maternal mental health something that they want to get close to. It's a Pandora's box for them. Yes. If I start asking these questions, what do I do if she says she doesn't feel good? What if I do if she wants to hurt her baby? Now, you know,
so they who am I going to send her to?
Exactly.
Where am I going to get the insurance? Who's going to take this
or
patient's
worse,
policy?
I just give her some antidepressants and send her home, you know, and without any kind of follow-up.
Right. Let me see what Megan from Virginia has to say. Hi, Megan. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi,
hi,
thank you so much for taking my call.
You're so welcome.
I wish I could sit with you guys for hours and pick your brains. I just made the decision 2 days ago to go with my therapist to go on to antidepressants for postpartum. And I gave birth to my daughter 14 months ago. So I'm wondering where the line is. Like, yeah. my husband asked me, how long does postpartum depression last? And I have no idea. And so I'm wondering where the line is between postpartum depression and depression, which I was diagnosed with in my 20s. So I am prone to depression.
Sure.
You know, anyway.
Sure. Yes. And Megan, hopefully, as you know, our guests do not know who you are. So whatever they say,
course.
And this is something you need to deal with directly with your doctor. But I still think it's a really good question. Now.
It's an excellent question because, Megan, you're not alone in trying to figure out through the first postpartum year, you know, because a lot of times people will say, well, it'll get better. It'll get better. And they'll get somewhat better. And then they have residual symptoms of depression. And so I'm so glad that you kept with your therapist and were able to talk about this and make some decisions. And yes, I mean, you know, I usually say if the depression starts within the first month after delivery, or you were feeling depressed in the third trimester, we label that as kind of sort of the official diagnosis of postpartum depression. However, I mean, anything that has its onset within the first few months after delivery is likely somehow related. Even if it's a relapse of a previous history of depression, it's still somewhat related to what's going on, whether it's the stress, the lack of sleep, or, you know, the hormonal adjustments. But regardless, you know, if the symptoms are continuing, it certainly is in your best interest to seek the treatment that you have. And so my hat goes off to you.
Can I just oversimplify this and say there really isn't that much difference? We're calling it postpartum depression because it's occurring within this time frame, which is what Neil said. But it's a clinical depression that needs to be addressed in the same way as it did when you were 20.
Right, absolutely.
Let me just read a couple of comments here. Rosemary, we can't take, unfortunately, all these calls. Maternity Care Coalition in Philadelphia wants to mention how increasingly difficult it is for low-income women
yes,
to obtain
absolutely.
Services.
And they're doing great work. And they're doing great work to try and get women the help they need. So, hats off to them.
Laura also says from Cherry Hill, this discussion is so important. PPD can cause a real rift in marriages. We didn't spend a lot of time on that, Karen, but, you know, one can only imagine in a relationship how that...
It is really hard on a marriage, and this is why we often want husbands to come in at some point during her treatment, either, you know, early, middle, or later, because it can destroy marriages. I mean, it's a challenge at best, and there are marriages that have ended because of it. It can bring up issues that preexisted the depression, and it can create its own issues.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Well, we are out of time, and we have so much more to talk about and many more callers and comments as well. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Neil Epperson, professor of psychiatry and obstetrics gynecology at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, also director of the Penn Center for Women's Behavioral Wellness and co-director of the Penn Promotes Research on Sex and Gender in Health. Karen Kleiman, founder and executive director of the Postpartum Stress Center on the Main Line, author of 9 books. books, including This Isn't What I Expected and Therapy and the Postpartum Woman. And a special thanks to our guest who also joined us, Lindsay Love, telling us a bit about what this was like for her. We really appreciate her joining us as well. And again, if you want to hear more of Liz Fiedler's conversation with her, go to whyy.org/radiotimes. Also, The Pulse today did a program on postpartum depression. You can check that out at newsworks.org/thepulse. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.